Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, as the Obama administration winds down, 100 days left, we are reminded again that the president has really advanced the cause of health and science during his tenure. He's not only attempted to expand healthcare to all Americans, he's also worked hard to advance the quality of care they receive by promoting bold scientific research projects.
Well, he has indeed, and the president hosted a Frontiers conference last week with leading scientists and researchers from many areas of interest, among them the president's BRAIN initiative, B-R-A-I-N, a coalition of scientists from around the country and around the world who've come together and joined forces to map one of the body's last great frontiers, and that's the human brain.
We had a co-director of that program on the show, Stanford's Dr. William Newsom, a brilliant neuroscientist who told us that the project will require the best minds from across the biosciences, computer science, and many other disciplines to tackle the brain's inherent mysteries and complexities. There's some really elegant research coming out of that initiative already.
Well, the president also spoke about his other recently launched Precision Medicine Initiative, which is seeking to mobilize 1 million citizen scientist volunteers to build a large biobank of health data along with information on behavior and environmental factors. And this should go a really long way toward advancing the cause of medical research across a wide spectrum of diseases which impact human health. It's a bold initiative. It's one that we're very excited to be participating in and really looking forward to that project getting underway.
And our good friend Eric Dishman, who we've had on the show, is also heading up. Talk about the great potential for improving our understanding of many diseases that impact human health. A very ambitious, very exciting project, Margaret. And you know, all of these initiatives would not be possible without the recent advances in digital health and information, something our guest today is a leading expert on.
Paul Saunier is one of the world's top analysts in the digital health space, and he's carved out a niche as one of the leading experts on all aspects of digital health. He's advised numerous organizations, including the World Economic Forum, on the convergence that's underway between digital technologies and genomics, which is impacting and will continue to impact health and healthcare all around the globe.
And Lori Robertson also stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public forum.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Paul Saunier in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The vice president's moonshot for cancer is making progress after 1 year. In a report released this week, the vice president outlined initiatives moving forward under the moonshot banner, seeking to double the speed of cancer research over the next 5 years. They plan to do it by increasing collaboration between government and industry, by simplifying clinical trials and fostering greater transparency. The report describes new measures to accelerate development of blood tests to diagnose cancer and identify which patients might benefit from specific treatments. The Defense Department will use artificial intelligence to analyze its collection of tissue from tumors to look for patterns that could predict cancer. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has launched a pilot program to cut in half the time to review certain cancer therapy patent applications from an average of 2 years to less than 12 months. Ride-sharing services such as Uber and Lyft will help patients get to the doctor and to clinical trials. And Microsoft and Amazon have committed to creating cloud storage for the effort. The president announced his Moonshot for Cancer initiative at his last State of the Union address, handing the mantle over to Vice President Biden, whose son, Beau, died of cancer last year. Obesity is a risk factor for cancer and also for diabetes and a whole host of chronic diseases. Obesity has more than doubled worldwide since 1980. And of the world's population of more than 7 billion, just under 2 billion are overweight, 600 million obese. The World Health Organization announcing an initiative to tackle obesity worldwide. Meanwhile, there's a growing evidence that placing a so-called soda tax on sugary beverages reduces consumption of such beverages significantly, leading to a great reduction in the consumption of sugar, which leads to obesity. Soda giant PepsiCo has announced an initiative to greatly reduce the amount of sugar in its sodas and other drinks by 2025. Kratom gets a reprieve. The Drug Enforcement Agency is delaying its decision to classify Kratom as a Class 1 substance on par with heroin and other narcotics. The drug, made from leaves of a coffee-like plant in Asia, has been used for centuries in that region as both a stimulant to increase work production as well as a relaxant. It's become increasingly popular among those chronic pain sufferers seeking to wean themselves off of opiates for pain relief, as well as weaning themselves off alcohol addiction and narcotics addiction. The DEA's recent announcement to give Kratom their most severe classification led to an outcry from users who've been using it effectively, as well as researchers desperately in search of alternatives to opioids for pain management. The DEA is looking for comment from the public till December 1st before making a final recommendation. And Mylan is paying the Piper a notable fine. The maker of the EpiPen, embroiled in controversy over its price spike in recent years, agreed to pay Medicare a fine of almost $500 million. Not only did the drug maker see massive profit increases over sales of the more expensive EpiPen, aimed largely at children and adults with life-threatening allergies, Medicare alleges its population was overcharged as well. The deal settles allegations by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that Mylan misclassified the EpiPen as a generic drug and had not paid the appropriate rebates required by law. Mylan said the settlement in no way provides for any finding of wrongdoing. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Paul Saunier, internationally renowned expert on digital health, founder and manager of Digital Health Group on LinkedIn, which has 50,000 members worldwide and over 30,000 followers on Twitter. He's also founder of The Story of Digital Health, a free website which provides followers with up-to-date analysis of emerging digital health technologies from around the world. Mr. Saunier served on the Strategic Advisory Board at Pathway Genomics, was vice president for the Wireless Life Science Alliance, and served as an advisor to the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda. He also served as a judge in the Nokia Sensing X Prize competition, a veteran of the U.S. Navy. Mr. Saunier earned his B.S. in Manufacturing Engineering from Western Washington University and an MBA from Seattle University. Paul, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you very much.
You know, you really carved out a niche for yourself. You're ranked as one of the top global influencers in the space. You consult on the emerging trends in digital health, which you say is empowering us to better track, manage, and improve our health. It also is making the healthcare delivery system more efficient, improving access, reducing cost, and increasing quality. I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners how digital health connects all of these dots together.
Oh, well, that's a very big question. As we're seeing, the digital revolution is converging with, you know, our health, the healthcare system, and also living in society. So we've got a full spectrum of tools and solutions out there, from apps and devices for both consumers and the healthcare system, as well as social media tools, which we use. And in one way or another, all of these digital solutions are impacting our health. So essentially what I do is I try to be an observer of all of this, share what I'm learning, catalyze what's happening, and really just enjoy making this, especially the term digital health, understood and more widely utilized, because I think it's an important way to catalyze what's happening by having a very simple, elegant term for what's happening that captures a lot of this other health tech terminology that we see out there.
Well, Paul, healthcare certainly has had to adapt to a variety of dramatic changes over the past decade, and maybe particularly since the passage of the HITECH Act, which really incentivized hospitals and practices and providers to make the great leap to electronic health records. So we've seen great progress in that transition, but not so much using all of the important health data that's available to us. So maybe talk with us about this transition to electronic health records happening really alongside the explosion of digital health technologies. How are these realities simultaneously growing and merging and changing the health consumer experience in particular?
Well, I think we're seeing the growing pains, especially in healthcare IT, EHRs, EMRs, where they really evolved into systems for billing and reimbursement versus improving the patient or the healthcare experience. So, you know, understandably, there are challenges there, especially with this sort of Cambrian explosion of apps and consumer devices out there and getting that data into the healthcare system. So, of course, we're seeing partnering to that end, notably Apple and other companies like Validic that take a lot of this consumer tech information and port that into the healthcare system. And, you know, again, these are not medical devices, and but even with medical devices, getting that information into the EHR is still sort of a challenge, and that's why you see this this need being addressed by various companies and partnerships. So, you know, I think the Affordable Care Act is good because it really pushes us in that direction, but we still have challenges around reimbursement. Largely, many healthcare systems are focused on that first, and, you know, they're going to put their resources where they're going to get their revenue. But, you know, I think we're making progress overall, and, you know, it's a noisy space, but I think we're getting there, and it's exciting to see.
Paul, you say the digital health revolution is benefiting society, and so let's look at some of the potential as well as the unpredictable ways that it's happening. Certainly on the predictable, the Affordable Care Act is pushing the health industry towards a system that supports value versus volume, but it's really hard to reinvent the system from the inside out. Tell our listeners how digital health movement, much of which is coming from the entrepreneurial space, is rising to meet the challenges within the healthcare system.
You've got to look at it through a couple of different prisms. So there's the external innovation, which happens in the consumer space, which does, you know, converge and bleed into the healthcare world with the data and the tracking, if you will, for example. And, you know, I look at that in many cases as being disruptive, because if these tools, which are largely, you know, many of them are adjuncts for our health, you know, they foster health and fitness, they can help reduce our disease risk. If we can be healthier and utilize less services, that's a disruption of the business model for healthcare. And then internally in healthcare, when you start doing things like remote patient monitoring and, of course, health IT systems, EHRs, EMRs, you can look at an enhancement of the current business processes for delivering healthcare. And that's disruptive to an extent, but I think more what we see there is enhancement of current processes. And, you know, one of the challenges is if processes are broken and you automate them, you don't necessarily get an improved outcome. And then you have this sort of marriage of the two worlds where, you know, fitness data, like from the Apple Watch, is being brought into Epic Systems EHR. Mm-hmm. And perhaps a clinician has, you know, suggested to their patient that they be more active. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do you measure and monitor that? And I would point out as well that in a lot of cases people say, well, you know, these wearables, for example, don't improve your health. And that's true. It's analogous to a gym membership.
Right.
you know, they may find that just walking on their own every day without any kind of tracking works great. But the fact is that the research is clear that inactivity, physical inactivity, increases our disease risk mm-hmm. enormously, you know, across the spectrum, especially chronic diseases, of course, diabetes, obesity, heart disease, and certain types of cancer. So it's really something that I think, you know, is this disruption happening broadly and across the spectrum. But it's, you know, it's hard to sort of track. I mm-hmm. think you can't just say, well, this is just digital health is a pill or a medical device, and here's the outcome. Mm-hmm. I think it's more nuanced than that.
Paul, I'd like to talk a little bit about the genomics part of this equation, which many entities are trying to commercialize. And you've brought up thought leaders like Dr. Eric Topol, who's been a guest on the show, and his ability to merge both the digital health and the genomic disciplines into one trajectory. So we're heading towards a new era of personalized medicine and precision medicine, but still without a really unified platform. So talk with us about how genomics and the discipline is inspiring companies like IBM and Apple to devise platforms that might help facilitate this interface between genomics and personalized medicine and digital health.
My definition of digital health does encompass genomics. You know, as Craig Venter said, basically our DNA is a digital code, genetic code, A, C, G's, and T's, just like ones and zeros for digital code. And he's even converting between the two. So this is the modern definition that I've promulgated since 2011, 2012, and that was inspired by the work of Eric Topol in his book, The Creative Destruction of Medicine. So he really opened my eyes to this sort of this revolution that's happening, and that genomics is part of it. As far as genomics goes, adoption and use of it, you know, there's a spectrum, you know, from 23andMe and Ancestry, to pharmacogenomics, disease diagnosis, and, you know, choosing the right medication based on your genetics. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of players in the space. You know, Illumina is one of the biggest sequencing companies, and there are tons of platforms out there. So there's not any, I think, unified or one company, if you will, but there's a lot of companies doing things. And of course, we see the Precision Medicine Initiative, you know, out of Washington, mm-hmm. and NIH, the Cancer Moonshot, you know, the vice president's right. effort, also working with the NIH and others. So, you know, I think it's a bit noisy, if you will, just like the rest of digital health. But we're seeing a lot of progress in that space. And, you know, I don't know if it'll all be unified. You know, we do see that this data does have issues, just like EHRs, with interoperability and sharing of the data. So that could certainly accelerate things if we could make that happen. Definitely, that's an opportunity.
We're speaking today with Paul Saunier, internationally recognized expert on digital health, founder and manager of the Digital Health Group on LinkedIn, which has 50,000 members worldwide and over 30,000 followers on Twitter. Paul, I want to pull the thread on that conversation you were just having with Margaret on precision medicine, the initiatives that are going out with the NIH, and really it's about the collection of data. And I wonder what your thoughts are on consumer-mediated apps. I mean, at the end of the day, consumers are in control of all of their data, but I'm not sure we figured out a way to know the trusted access that people should have to their accounts. What's going on then in that world around the mediated apps and the development there?
So, you know, speaking of Eric Topol, he recently co-authored a piece in Nature with John Wilbanks, who is focused a lot on this data and the sharing of it. And the title of their piece was Stop the Privatization of Health Data.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hurdle. I'm not sure that, you know, consumers at this point, they're kind of used to having their services for free. And, you know, as they say, if it's free, then you're the product. So, you know, perhaps with evolving platforms like Apple's doing a lot of partnering, very focused on consumer privacy and ownership of the data. But Apple, I think, is really sort of being aggressive in this space. They recently purchased a company called Glimpse, which is a personal health record system. They're doing a lot of partnerships with healthcare organizations. And, you know, perhaps they could be this sort of central source where the consumer actually owns that data and can meet it out and have it used as they wish.
Let's talk, if we can now, for a minute about how digital health can shift the cost paradigm. So we have this annual health budget in the U.S. of around $3.5 trillion. 86% of global health costs are based on chronic disease management. And you've got some interesting data on how self-monitoring health apps and wearables can significantly impact overall health costs. Maybe give us some examples of how entrepreneurs are finding ways to maximize the use of all this new personalized health data.
The data on the outcomes or the results, if you will, of a lot of these consumer apps and devices is sort of hit or miss. You know, we've seen a recent report come out that, you know, wearables don't necessarily improve weight loss. From that perspective, are we talking about obesity or just a couple of pounds? I think the differential is 5 pounds. The biggest risk factors in chronic disease are typically physical inactivity. And an interesting study just came out from Stanford and Microsoft Research on Pokemon Go. You know, that was a big splash.
Loved it.
Yeah, you know, and I thought it was fantastic, too. It still is. It's sort of waned in the number of users. I think it's down to 25 or 30 million from a high of 45 million, something like that. But they did a study and said, well, if people play this game regularly and they maintain that play, right, versus, you know, sort of a medically directed right. activity, you know, I think the evidence is out there. These are consumer solutions, games, wearables that foster physical activity. Certainly, you know, when you have 25 million people who maintain greater levels of physical activity, that's a population health benefit that I don't think can be ignored.
First of all, I got to say, I'm very jealous of you. You've got a great perch looking at all these forward-thinking technologies. You've got a front row seat as a judge in the exciting Nokia Sensing X Prize competition. I'm wondering if you can tell us about how that competition has been going and what else are you seeing out there that excites you?
Yeah, I think that as we can get diagnostics and health monitoring into the consumer's hands versus having to go into a brick and mortar hospital, let's say. This whole realm of at-home diagnostics really does sort of change the status quo of healthcare. You know, solutions like Scanadu, I saw one today, the world's smallest DNA sequencer or analyzer, they're calling it, which could potentially do diagnostics in the home. So, I think that segment of digital health represents an enormous amount of potential. You know, right now what we see is we have, WebMD, which gets 200 million unique visitors a month. So that health information, people are actually diagnosing themselves based on that. Mm-hmm. And that is a valuable digital health tool. So we just start moving that needle of solutions to the consumer, and that can help really change healthcare itself. You know, as you pointed out, this $3 trillion, 86% of the costs are due to chronic preventable diseases, according to the CDC.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can cut down on that and diagnose those sooner or more efficiently, we can reduce the cost burden overall. So it's very exciting to watch.
Well, it is exciting indeed. And we think about our own experience. We provide care to a large underserved population. And when we think about our patients, we recognize there is something of a health disparity gap, even in access and use of these technologies. And I understand you've advised the World Economic Forum on this topic. How do we fill the gap or avoid yet another example of a health disparity between the customer who's the proactive, self-tracking Apple Watch user and really able to make a big bang of a difference, and those who just haven't had access to it?
Great question. Definitely we see that a lot of the devices that are available, like the Fitbits, they come with a cost. And
right.
Let's say you're not with an employer who's going to subsidize or pay for it, or an insurer that's going to cover that. Certain parts of the population could fall through the cracks. But again, that's not to say that those are necessary. Physical activity and nutrition and things like that, you don't necessarily need digital health for that. And I mentioned, WebMD, which is an internet tool, which, by and large, most people have access to the internet. Do they know that information is available? That's another question. So there's going to be hits or misses, I think, especially in certain populations. But, I don't think they're going to be missing out by and large. Mm-hmm. I think they will benefit as this access improves. Example that I like recently was Kaiser Permanente. The CEO, Bernard Tyson, was at the Salesforce meeting in San Francisco last week. And I had no idea, but they had done 52% of their visits have been done virtually out of something like 110 million in the last year. So you can see where people that may not be able to come into the healthcare system can have healthcare essentially remotely. And that reduces the cost burden, that can be more focused on prevention. They also had a recent report come out saying that they had reduced heart attacks in almost 4 million of their members in Northern California. And I would assume it's based in part on these virtual visits and these preventative measures.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not going to be all digital health, I think, but and I don't think we're going to reach everyone. It's not, ubiquitous per se. But certainly, we can impact and then reach out into these underserved communities a little bit better, I think, via digital technology. I don't necessarily think that there's going to be big losers in this case. I think it's going to be a net win.
We've been speaking today with Paul Saunier, social entrepreneur, founder of The Story of Digital Health, a free website providing followers with up-to-date analysis of emerging digital health developments from around the world. You can learn more about his work by going to storyofdigitalhealth.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at Paul_Saunier, S-O-N-N-I-E-R. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Well, thank you, Mark and Margaret, and I really appreciate this opportunity.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In the second presidential debate, Republican Donald Trump falsely claimed that Democrat Hillary Clinton wanted to implement a single-payer healthcare system like Canada's. Clinton supports allowing those over age 55 to buy into Medicare and creating a public option or a federal insurance plan that would compete with private plans on the ACA exchanges. She hasn't called for a single-payer system in which everyone has coverage provided by the government. In fact, during the Democratic primary campaign, it was Senator Bernie Sanders, not Clinton, who called for a single-payer system, or what he termed Medicare for All. Clinton criticized that idea, saying, quote, "I don't believe, number one, we should be starting over. We had enough of a fight to get to the Affordable Care Act." Before the Affordable Care Act was passed, we heard many versions of Trump's claim. Republicans repeatedly warned of a government takeover of health care, but the ACA didn't do that. Instead, it built upon and expanded private insurance as well as Medicaid. Earlier versions of the legislation contained a public option or a federal insurance plan that would be offered along with private insurance on the ACA exchanges, where people who buy their own insurance can get coverage. Republicans claimed this public option would eventually lead to a Canadian or British-style system. As we wrote at the time, the impact of the public option would depend on how it was structured. But one of the final versions of the House bill would have led to about 6 million Americans joining the public plan, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. The public option wasn't included in the final legislation. Since the debate, Trump has claimed that apparent excerpts of Clinton's paid speeches from 2013 to 2015, contained in hacked and leaked emails by WikiLeaks, also show she wants a single-payer system. But the quotes don't show that. Instead, Clinton advocates building on the United States employer-based system to get to universal coverage. For more information on those speech excerpts, see our website at factcheck.org. And that's my Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, Managing Editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Diabetes is a chronic illness for which behavioral choices such as diet and exercise are extremely important. But incentivizing behavior change in large patient populations is very challenging. A recent study done by Emory University, Northwestern University, and a nonprofit organization focused on improving the health of India's population of close to a billion people found that text messages sent through smartphones might be a powerful tool in promoting diabetes prevention behaviors. They partnered with India's leading provider of mobile phones, Nokia, to harness a research cohort of a million clients to receive diabetes prevention text messages.
So we wanted to use text messages in multiple languages to influence behavior change. So the text messages themselves were developed with Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health because we wanted them based on science and behavior change theory. And then we adapted them with lots of consumer feedback.
Nalini Saligram, CEO of the Arogya Foundation, says the prevalence of diabetes for those of Indian descent is dramatically higher, four times higher than those in Western populations. The text messaging study was designed to generate improved activity around four simple goals: consume more fruits and vegetables, avoid fried foods, and exercise regularly.
You know, the messages themselves were quite simple, but the sequence of the messages and how frequently they were texted was all based on behavior change theory as well as on Nokia's experience from their consumer base. So we ended up sending it twice a week for 6 months.
After a six-month trial period, researchers saw some promising results. Participants who received just two text messages per week, reminding them to keep their diet and exercise goals, showed an average 40% more compliance with those activities than those who did not receive the messages. Dr. Saligram says it could prove a useful tool for clinicians trying to affect behavior change across large patient populations and across a variety of chronic illnesses. A low-cost, targeted text messaging system sent directly to consumers, reminding them of the power they have to maintain simple lifestyle changes that can improve their chances of preventing or better managing diabetes and other chronic illnesses linked to lifestyle. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.